a very cliche graph of the up and down life cycle of an entrepreneur where it's like, hey, we figured out everything. Oh, we're going to die. And it always trends up. And to be honest, it does trend up because as you figure out more things, as you check those boxes, but it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like the curve gets more and more extreme. And so you started from little wiggles where you're like, hey, is this going to work? If it doesn't, it's okay. And then it's, oh my God, we're going to really do this big, all the way down to this is a nightmare. Even though it is trending up, your emotions are just riding that. So you have to rein that in, realize that you are actually figuring more and more things out. And because of that, the stakes are getting higher. More people rely on you. So you, again, just like we were talking about, sales, research, all of that is the biggest question mark at any level of SaaS. So you need to go and tackle that first. And you need to say, hey, people are going to buy, are people going to buy this? And once they say yes, then go build it. And you can do that a little bit in parallel, but you don't want to waste time chasing greener pastures that are hypothetical.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to SaaS and Scotch. I'm TK, founder at Unstoppable. On this podcast, I talk about the two things I love the most, SaaS businesses and Lagavulin Scotch. On today's episode, we have Tito Goldstein joining us, co-founder and CEO of Zira. We'll be digging into his founder story and the incredible work he's doing at the intersection of SaaS and I want to say staffing management. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
Doing great, TK. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great way to kick it off. You're at Thanksgiving, you're meeting grandma. How do you explain to grandma what you guys do?
Yeah, so my grandma has trouble with an iPhone and SaaS software is definitely complicated to explain, but I'll do my best. Zira is a workforce management tool and we use AI and automation to really optimize those repetitive tasks that managers today are going into a back room and spending 50 to 75% of their time doing. So that's the high level of what Zira does.
That's awesome. So I took a look at your background. It was fascinating because you're ex-Uber. You were at Uber before. Mm-hmm. And before that, you were at Hyperloop. Is that the same Hyperloop as like Elon Musk's Hyperloop?
So Elon Musk, when he did the Hyperloop thing, he basically just said, here are my plans. Here's my vision. All these other companies, I dare you to do it. Yeah. A couple companies took that charge up. And one of them was HTT, which did it in a very distributed, like crowdsourced model. So I was helping doing some of the design work for their dashboards and some of the monitoring interfaces and some of the hubs that they eventually wanted to build. Very speculative, but pretty cool stuff. And be able to go into the warehouses and see these giant Hyperloop mockups and some of the visualizations that we were working on.
That's so cool. The reason I ask is I always like to get into, we definitely want to talk about the incredible work you're doing at Zira. But before that, transportation with Hyperloop, transportation with Uber, at least from the outside in, how'd you come up with the idea? How'd you like decide like, this is the thing I want to go build? What was the motivation behind it? Let's talk about that first.
Sure, I'll take a little bit of a step back. My path is very, maybe typical, but also maybe atypical in the fact that I have no design background in terms of education. I studied international relations at USC and I basically said, you know what, this degree is general education. It's not going to really move my career one way or another. So I started doing a lot of hacky, startup-y, my own company things on the side that helped pay the rent. But I slipped into design by just hacking on my own stuff and learning some of the tools. And that eventually got me the job at Uber, where I met my co-founder actually. And we had the privilege of being able to talk with thousands of drivers throughout the world. And that kind of experience is pretty unique where you're not sitting in, you know, your ivory tower, your tech company, and just building solutions for white collar workers who are also sitting at desks. You're actually trying to understand a completely different mindset and be able to design a product that someone who might not even speak the language that's on their phone needs to be able to pick this app up, be able to know exactly where they need to drive to, provide great service, and follow kind of these instructions to earn their living. So that experience and really understanding kind of the blue collar workforce and the Uber drivers gave us one perspective that was super unique. And the other side was I was leading design for a while on Uber for Business. So there was this nice mesh with my experience as well as my co-founder who came from Salesforce of SaaS and also blue collar and hourly workers that we thought was a kind of unique perspective. And from that, we just started thinking like, hey, we're a good pair. We have a lot of success here at Uber. How do we replicate that? So we started going and actually talking boots on the ground to everyone we could. And we kept hearing this idea of scheduling as a pain point. That's the source of truth between an employee and an employer. So we started designing out solutions from there, and our natural product sense and our natural kind of inquisitiveness started really picking us up. And we started realizing that there's no ubiquitous, super well-known brand out there that's managing 80% of the world's workforce. All of these workdays, all of these sales forces are designed for people sitting at desks that honestly probably need great tools a little bit less. Like they already have such a nice suite of tools behind them, but the data, the quality of tools, and the quality of the experience of the majority of the world is still left behind.
It's so fascinating because you're right. That's I didn't know that was a stat. 80% of the workforce in the world is some sort of like frontline or blue collar, like shift based work. Is that how you think about
it? 80% of that world's workforce is hourly. It's a little bit lower in the US and a little bit higher outside of the US.
Yeah, that's crazy. And in the spectrum, I think you're right. I would think that on one end of the spectrum, you've got Amazon warehouses where I don't think they even think of people as humans anymore, that it's like swappable, like energy buckets almost is what it feels like. And then the other extreme, and they get efficiently managed and they've been called out for overmanaging and almost treating them as it's almost inhumane. And on the other end, you have the mom and pop shop, like restaurant that has a staff of three people, and then the mom will pitch in if the scheduling doesn't work on someone calls in sick. Is that right?
Yeah, it's really interesting to see the spectrum because on one end you have, hey, this employee is the face of your brand because they're engaging with a customer. And then the other half, you're mentioning the Amazon, it's like this employee is not the face, but they're the lifeblood of your company because if they don't do their job, if they're not efficient, your margins slip and everything goes haywire. So no matter what, this is like the connective tissue of a company and it's so crucial. So these companies understand the metrics of retention. They understand the metrics of employee morale and proficiency, but they're still using these 1920s-esque punitive management styles. And I really think the reason is because they don't have the flexibility or the tools to move into more of an engaging, gamified, and upward mobility-based management style. We already see from companies like Uber, where you reduce like the number of employees per manager and you make it more of that interpersonal connection, that you get like a 70% boost in performance versus the MBAs from the 1920s saying, hey, you get 20% if you start punishing every bad action. So there's an opportunity here to really boost productivity of the entire world, give people more meaningful jobs, and also give them that path towards upward mobility. But the tools right now have just never been set up for that because no one's thinking like, hey, how do I give my frontline retail employee a way up? Instead, it's like, hey, they're going to churn. We know they're going to churn and we're just going to get the most out of them and move on with our day. The mentality shifting, but I don't think the tools have shifted as fast as that mentality in the last, let's say, 5-10 years.
Yeah. You guys are coming up on year 4 of the business, right?
So we sat down, I think it was a Thanksgiving break, and we just like everyone was taking it off and me and Arjun just sat down and designed the whole thing. We officially raised in end of 2019, actually. And before that, it was all just kind of referrals and people using it, like us validating our concepts. And then it's really more blown up in the last 12 to 18 months with, I think, us figuring out some of the go-to-market, me and Arjun moving more into the sales side of things, which is just natural, I think, for founders at this stage to be able to stay close to the problems. So yeah, I don't think it's quite 4 years, but it definitely feels like that.
Okay, got it. Yeah, so did I hear you say it right? Like you raised at the end of 2019. So that means you raised and then you went into the pandemic with frontline workers or shift workers, yep. Obviously being like, what was that like?
It was interesting. We had some customers that were using it and they all pretty much disappeared because they were factories in India. They were retail shops in the US. They were restaurants here in SF.
Yeah.
And they were just shut down. A lot of other businesses, a lot of other startup founders I talked to said they had a lot of different strategies, some of which sounded terrifying to me. It was like the wait and be ready strategy. And that's risky. The other was let's just shift over to something completely COVID related. We felt pretty confident in our ability to design a product that people wanted and needed. At the same time, we knew that it might be a slightly different go-to-market otherwise. We couldn't go door-to-door in restaurants in SF and Berkeley and say, hey, check out this cool new thing. Here's a free iPad. You want to try it? Do that, which might have been the plan otherwise. So we had to mature to a level of sales that might have been a year down the road where now we're cold calling, now we're doing outbound email, now we're paying for more paid lead sources and starting to create the sales engine that we would need to scale. Which might have been a blessing, might have been a curse because it was probably a more growing pain for me and Argent to do that, not coming from a sales background. And now we're just in the thick of it. Like, our life is pretty much sales. And that's also created such alignment with the team because there's so much inbound, there's so much interest that we know exactly, hey, 10 people have mentioned this feature and only two have mentioned that feature. And here's the size of those two companies. So now the team isn't really, what should we build next? We're still trying to find that market that cares about what we're building. Instead, it's, hey, if we build this, these five people are unlocked and we know we can close them. And luckily with a small team, we're moving pretty fast so we can rapidly iterate, not only on the product, but then on the demos and the sales then the next day and say, did this work? Well, because we built it.
That is so powerful. I feel like this point is missed on a lot of new founders. It's, if you can spin up go-to-market, if you're locked in on an ICP, like at least pick a target audience, which you guys did. We want to solve this problem around business owners that have shift workers. The more conversations you have, the easier it becomes to get to product market fit because they'll literally just tell you. Mm-hmm. And if you can just optimize for the number of conversations, you can move, like your roadmap will get dictated for you instead of you having to guess and trying to be a genius that says, no one wants a faster horse. Like I'm going to invent like that. Like it's not even a real thing there. Like that's actually a misnomer of a quotation.
Yeah. The funny thing is all cliches eventually come true. So plenty of people, plenty of investors have given us advice, do 500 conversations as fast as you can. Having 500 conversations is great. The question is, how do you find those 500 people that are actually going to give you the honest feedback? And most of them will, but are they the right, are they business yeah. owners? Are they the right people you're selling to? And that being said, then do you have like the product sense to turn it around into what they need? Like everyone loves the cliche of the Steve Jobs thing. It's if he had asked his customers, they might not have asked for an iPhone, but they probably would have asked for a lot of the features that the iPhone unlocked. And he just then packaged it up and decided, hey, we can do a full touchscreen here.
The nuance is it has to be sales conversations. Like I know that a lot of investors are like, do lots of customer development. And it's like, people lie. They'll tell you all kinds, they'll give you a wish list, but you can go build that exact wish list and come back. That doesn't mean they're going to swipe the credit card either.
They're going to tell you what you're leading them to versus if they're selling and their money's on the line. And I think someone gave us this advice way back when. It's like, hey, do those calls, do the research, but then ask them for money. Like say, will you pay for this? And if they're like, maybe, then everything that they just told you is probably not super valuable.
Yeah. All the founders that I work with, they're earlier stage than you guys. Like when they're initially scaling revenues before they do outbound or says, ask for $1,000 pilot. And you'll know very quickly on everything they told you in the last hour if they really mean it or not. Yeah. If they're like, maybe, then you're like, it's a piece of paper out.
Give me that credit card number. Put it into my Stripe account.
Yeah. So what's interesting about you guys, and a lot of founders deal with this, especially with SaaS, you mentioned earlier that this was maybe a slightly different way of thinking about how to manage shift workers, or the management style might be different, or maybe there's the one person that keeps it all in their head on the scheduling and has their process, and maybe they felt threatened with your automated solution. Can you walk me a little bit about, walk me through what that was like when you were first starting out and laying out the groundwork?
Sure. I have no doubt that there's going to be continuing and lots of education for us as we move forward, because we are, again, trying to slightly rewrite the playbook for this industry. Most of our competitors, most people in the space, they've done a really good job since the 90s digitizing the pen and paper process and bringing it over to, hey, now it's all digital. So the communication is a little bit easier and you can do things maybe a little bit quicker and it's stored in the cloud. So it's safe forever. But we come to the table and say, hey, your managers shouldn't be doing any of the stuff they're doing. Like the stuff they're spending 15% of the time on, that should be nearly all of their time. And now your retention goes through the roof. Your employees have a transparent experience. So it's been a little bit interesting of a challenge just to educate people, especially when COVID hit and we were selling mainly to states that were staying open, like the South, and a lot of people in these demographics that are maybe small retail owners, small restaurant owners, they naturally have an aversion or a fear of technology. Yep. So when we come in and we say AI and automation, they're like, nope, too complicated for me, I'm out. So we've had to get pretty good, at least it's becoming more of a sales playbook so we can scale it. But we're getting pretty good at being able to use the right language with the right people and having those right discovery questions, the natural sales conversation flow. It's definitely an ongoing process. And the nice thing that we do, and we definitely want to lean on our strengths as we're over-indexed on design and product as a team, with me and Arjun both being product designers in our past lives. So we want to make sure that most people can come in and build an automation in Xero with little to no training. And the cool thing is, from his Salesforce experience and kind of our product jams, is the way we built our automation engine is that it really unlocks our sales conversations when someone says, hey, I want to be able to do this. And no one else has been able to do that. It was like, we can do anything in Xero because we didn't define the playbook. It's not a out of the box restaurant solution. It's not an out of the box warehouse solution, but it's the root functionality with simple interactions so you can actually build exactly what you need. So that kind of unlocks the sales motion. And there is probably a little bit more heavy lifting on us to onboard people. But the cool thing is that's UI tweaks and education that we can start building into the product once we get to a scale where it's just no longer manageable or feasible for any of us to be helping.
This is a core pattern, I think, in a lot of SaaS businesses. You're essentially going in, looking someone in the eye and saying, that thing you spend 85% of your time on that you get paid for, we'll just automate it. So you can focus on that 15%. And on one hand, the person is, oh, thank God, I hated doing that part. On the other hand, a lot of people, their self-identity, their self-worth, their job security is tied to that 85% that you don't want to do that anymore. How did you, what was that for you guys? Was it both? Was it one? How did you navigate that?
Yeah, I think we figured that was going to be a problem very early on, especially if you think about a restaurant manager, like the control over the schedule and the be able to place certain people where a lot of that is, hey, that's all in my head. Like you can't pretend like a computer can know that Tito can work the Friday night shift, Arjun should work the Saturday morning shift because they're better at two different things.
Yep. And Melanie's like, probably going to flake and start your plan.
Yeah. Like these are the people I'm not going to show. So I'm going to overstaff. So it's definitely an interesting shift there. And there might be a little bit of that chasm between the early adopters and the people who, but the nice thing is we saw this coming. So we designed in the product, like very much managerial control, but then constant nudges towards, hey, here's a better way. Hey, you keep reminding people that they missed a clock out. Why not set up an automation that just says, hey, 30 minutes after the shift ended, are you actually still at the store? Or should have you clocked out? And if not, let the manager know and help us automate the fixing of the time. So then we start to nudge them towards, like, hey, this is a better way to do it. And also provide them suggestions throughout the way. So we can automate a beautiful schedule that does take into account all those little nuances about an employee. But if they're not trusting us, they can click on a single shift and we're going to then show you them the recommended person at the top. So now they're like, wait, am I just going through each of these shifts and using Xero's recommendation? If I am, maybe I'll just click the smart assign to do the whole thing. So that's the thing, the story there, but also we want them to be thinking more about their employees and their own upward mobility. It's, hey, what happens to this business if your whole job is automated and you can focus on growth, creative sales strategies, all the things that will actually, you know, make the company more money, make every employee happier. And if you can do that, then the company grows and you grow your kind of army and everyone growing their, what the prospect of what they're responsible for in their charter.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. We took a similar approach like back in the TaoDab days. A lot of salespeople were like, are you guys trying to replace us? Or SDRs, like, are you trying to replace us? And we always use the Iron Man analogy. It's like, we're not trying to replace you. We're trying to give you an Iron Man suit. We're the Iron Man suit. We give you superpowers. Yeah. And I think that always works in sales messaging and marketing messaging. It's like, you're giving the people superpowers versus trying to replace 85% of their, what you deem to be mundane work, which exactly. It probably is, but you, that's a better way to position is what I've found also.
Yep. And our goal is definitely, I think in some of our sales decks, we have the exact same things. Like, how do you make every manager a superhero? Yeah. Because now they're able to create perfect seconds and like perfect schedules in a second. And now your payroll person isn't spending the whole Friday changing little things based on how much mileage someone needed for a specific location. All of that stuff is automated. So now these people are, again, using their creative human brain power to make the business better rather than just keep the lights on.
Yeah. Both you and your co-founder is a dangerous combination of product designers turned salespeople. On one hand, it's probably like a dream come true for a designer because you get to talk to tons of users all day long. On the other hand, so let's talk a little bit around what was that transition like? How do you like it? What was your perception of sales before and how is it now?
So I will caveat it with both me and Arjun, even when we were at Uber and like he was head of driver design and I was head of U4B, we would call ourselves fraud designers. Like we think anyone can probably design. It's just about whether you decided to pick up the tools and learn how to drag a rectangle across a screen. And it's very logical. Like someone's like, hey, I need to do this. Give them a clear button to do that. There's some visual design that really is like, there's amazingly skilled people at visual design and there's some skills that are hard to learn there. So I will caveat with, we don't think of ourselves purely as designers or even product. The transition to sales was super interesting. It was just out of necessity. We were like, hey, the product's in a decent place, but we need to start getting a lot of feedback. We need to see who's going to pay for this. We need to see which markets really start resonating with the story. And we also need to start like this inbound and this flow of money and start using our brain power to solve those problems. Once we jumped into it, we probably sucked at it, like early on. Like we had no idea. Like I'd call up a lead and just be like, let me pitch the whole thing to you in this 5 seconds here. I have you on the phone. And people are like, what's going on? What the hell? Then we started reaching out to people for help, started bringing in more experienced people in the sales world and realized, hey, that call is really just an intro and try to get a meeting.
Yep.
And so these different kind of nuanced things, make sure you have a follow-up, make sure the structure of the sales call is like rapport building, ask as many questions as you can, and that will guide the demo. And the cool thing about Zira is it's so flexible and easy for us to build out the demos that usually when they answer 3 or 4 questions, I can change the demo to completely what they need. And then they're just mind blown when 3 seconds later, they see the labels, the names, the locations that they just mentioned to me or Arjun or any of the salespeople here in what we're showing. And they're just like, if it's that easy to just customize on the fly, then the tool's probably pretty powerful. So we've started to figure that out. And it's not just us doing it. Sure, there was some painful learning curve, but also just asking as many questions and trying to pull in as many resources from people who have done this. Because the sales model hasn't been revolutionized that much. It's still, especially in the SaaS world, it's still pretty manual. It's still cold outreach, warm inbounds, and then the sales process. And do you have the sales assets, the scripts, the demo, the decks, whatever it is to make you look like a professional brand and build that trust and then deliver on what that customer's asking for.
Yeah. What's it been like selling to your demographic where maybe they're too busy operating the restaurant or the brick and mortar and not necessarily on LinkedIn or Facebook, like channel wise, what's worked really well for you guys? What have you learned?
We have a lot of different inbound channels like paid lead sources. And since we convert at a really high clip when we're actually in a meeting, anything that's getting us meetings, we're willing to pay a premium for. I've been trying to get better at, I haven't done it, you know, in a decade, but get better at SEM and paid search to try to see how we can optimize that. We need to probably build out the website and our landing pages more to make that worthwhile. And then actually, once we start figuring out an industry, once we have enough like data points to say, hey, the pain points are so obvious to us, we can speak that language. Then we do like outbound. So we do email outbound, which it's sad, but it's still really viable, maybe even more so than LinkedIn, because LinkedIn spam is getting pretty wild and the noise there is probably hitting, you know, starting to make that no longer a viable channel in a lot of ways. But the email outbound, if we put a little bit more effort into the email and the content and speak that customer's language, usually it seems like we can convert some pretty nice accounts from a blast out and like a sequence like that.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've learned that with that type of demographic, LinkedIn is, they just don't hang out there as much. They're not looking to professionally grow.
I'm still waiting for FaceTime voicemail because I would love to leave people like time and say, hey, this is what I'm calling for. But and it might just be cognitive dissonance if you get a FaceTime from a random number. I think that would be, and texting even, I've seen with some of the smaller and some of our BDRs have been just like texting as soon as they see that it goes blue and they're like, I know this person has an iPhone. Like I'm going to.
That's amazing. I want to close on this question. I feel like we could talk forever around sales and just all the stuff you guys are doing. Let's close on this one. So everyone listening is just like you and I. We're doing the Shawshank crawl to next stage of growth. And for the founders, I know a lot of founders out there struggle with, do I keep staying in the one more feature trap or do I kind of put on the suit and go do the sales and marketing, embrace the sales and marketing? You did that transition. At one point, you and Arjun, your co-founder, said, no, we got to go do this thing now. What's the piece of advice you would give to those kind of founders that are at that stage and kind of hemming and hawing or maybe wondering if it's the right time now that you're on the other side of it?
Yeah, I would say it's probably never too early. I'd say if you can go out and sell it to someone and all it is a prototype and you have to churn that person because you don't have the product you promised them, that's a data point that's probably more valuable than spending weeks in an office or with your team saying, hey, let's build some stuff that we hypothesize people could want. Because ultimately, unless you're, and we are coming from a slightly unique perspective, we weren't fully in the industry we were building for. Like we were building because we knew we could build a great product. We had some hypotheses about the core root problem that all these employees were experiencing, but we didn't know anything about proper restaurant operations, especially at scale. We didn't know anything about staffing agencies or manufacturing plants. But we can absorb that. And when we started selling, you see the objections. And as soon as you hear that objection, you should go write that down and write 10 answers to it or write down 10 different options on how a feature could potentially revolutionize that objection. I'd say it's never too early. I'd say jump into sales even before you have a product, even before you go fundraising to prove that someone wants what you're selling. And if you can sell one in 10, like early on while you're still just learning the trade, that can be optimized. And then you already have a viable business. You just need to now talk with 1,000 people and you've got 100 clients. So really it's invaluable. It's basically the equivalent of doing customer research, usability studies, sales research, all of that wrapped into one meeting and finding out exactly where the sticking points are. And if you don't get enough data from that meeting, come to the table with something different and keep iterating, experimenting. There are plenty of places where you can pay for leads. And if you can spin up enough of a ghost vaporware thing to run that test, that sales call is going to be more valuable than any amount of jams with your team, as much as you think you understand the industry.
That's so on point. I totally agree. I think more founders should do it like from day one so that they know they're building the right features. And these days, I think proposing a pilot and just saying, hey, we're building this. We'd love you to have you on our advisory board. We'd love to have you on a paid pilot. And we'll also give you a completely risk-free guarantee where in 3 months, if we don't hit our milestones, we'll give your money back. Yep. Like people would be more, like if you're truly solving an important urgent problem, people will say yes to that. And yep. It's not even sketchy. You're being upfront about it too, like at that point. It's super powerful. I think more founders should do that. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, and it's going to suck. So switching from whatever you're comfortable with to sales, especially since sales is something that's probably the farthest from what founders were doing before, where you're getting rejected constantly, you're having to just up your level of energy, even when you're having the worst day and you're turning around from knowing that there's a massive bug in the problem to talking with someone and telling them it's the best thing in the world. That's a really almost a sociopathic shift you have to make constantly, but it's really important to your team. And then making sure it's transparent to your team so that you're not having to regurgitate, hey, this is what I heard. They should be a part of that. So your team is then all aligned and focused on the right things from that sales call. So that's changing and shifting the company's direction very organically to the right problem.
Yeah. Yeah. It's totally going to suck. It's really hard, but I think as founders, we have to choose which one sucks less. Now, there's never a decision of this is way greener. Let's just go this. No, which one sucks less is kind of the decision you're making. I'll tell you what sucks more. If you don't do it, you build out this product and you raise like $3 million and then you go hire a junior marketer. The junior marketer spends $1 million and runs the ads. And then you're like, no one wants it. You're not closing any deals. And you fire the junior marketer and you try to hire another junior marketer. And 18 months has passed. And then you realize no one wants what we built because we didn't try and sell it on day one and put on the suit and just go do it. So that sucks more, I would say.
It does. And it's funny because I was talking with Arjun today. And the very cliche graph of, okay, the founder kind of up and down life cycle of an entrepreneur where it's like, hey, we figured out everything. Oh, we're going to die. Hey,
the trough of sorrow.
Exactly. And it always trends up. And to be honest, it does trend up because as you figure out more things, as you check those boxes, but it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like the curve gets more and more extreme. And so you started from little wiggles where you're like, hey, is this going to work? If it doesn't, it's okay. And then it's, oh my God, we're going to really do this big, all the way down to this is a nightmare. Even though it is trending up, your emotions are just riding that. So you have to rein that in, realize that you are actually figuring more and more things out. And because of that, the stakes are getting higher, more people rely on you. So you, again, just like we were talking about, sales, research, all of that is the biggest question mark at any level of SaaS. So you need to go and tackle that first. And you need to say, hey, are people going to buy this? And once they say yes, then go build it. And you can do that a little bit in parallel, but you don't want to waste time chasing greener pastures that are hypothetical.
We're going to end on that because that is so on point. And that's going to be the teaser for the episode. Tito, this was awesome. I truly enjoyed talking to you and learning from you. And I know our audience is going to love it too. Congrats on all the progress and congrats on taking the glass for breakfast and going into sales and marketing and embracing it. And clearly it's paying off. So super excited for you guys. And thank you for joining.
Yeah, I appreciate that, TK. This is TK. This was awesome. Super excited to be a part of it. Excited to hear it when it comes out. And feel free to reach out anytime. This is a long road ahead for us in Zira, but it definitely feels cool to be doing something unique, something a little bit off the beaten path. And honestly, about Zira, most people look at it, it's like, this isn't a sexy space to be. But it's really cool and engaging to see a team rally around this cause that they might not have understood from day one coming in, but they realize the potential. And that's, you know, what motivates, I think, probably most founders is that potential to step outside their comfort zone, do something big, even with the lucrative deals that Google and Facebook and Uber might be offering. This is something that's truly unique and it's an experience of a lifetime. And I'm super excited to be a part of it, super excited to have our team on board and see where the next steps take us.
It's awesome. In the show notes, if you want to get in touch with Tito, We'll put his LinkedIn profile. We'll also link to Zira at zira.ai if you want to learn more about what they're working on. If you liked this episode, please let us know by tweeting it out. Give us a 5-star review. There's a click to tweet link in the episode description. And remember, everyone needs a strategy for their life and their business. When you are with us, yours is going to be unstoppable. I'm TK, and I'll see you in the next episode.